Königsberg, Prussia, circa 1784. Every afternoon at exactly 3:30 p.m., a little man in a powdered wig and tri-corner hat steps out of his house on Prinzessinstrasse. Immanuel Kant is so punctual on his daily walk that locals joke their neighbors could set their clocks by him. Today, however, Kant's routine is broken. He's engrossed reading a new book, Rousseau's Emile, and misses his walk. The townsfolk are astonished. This anecdote, true or apocryphal, reflects Kant's life, orderly, disciplined, dedicated entirely to a life of the mind that would revolutionize philosophy. How did this quiet professor become one of the most influential thinkers of all time? Immanuel Kant was born in 1724 in Königsberg, a provincial capital on the Baltic Sea, today Kaliningrad. He was raised in a modest artisanal family and educated in a pietistic Lutheran tradition that stressed duty and virtue. Young Kant was intellectually precocious. He studied at the University of Königsberg, never venturing more than 100 miles from his birthplace his entire life. After some years as a private tutor, he became a professor at Königsberg and taught there for 4 decades. Kant's early work was in natural science. He hypothesized about the formation of the solar system, the Kant-Laplace nebular hypothesis, showing his broad curiosity. But his lasting fame comes from his critical philosophy, which he started developing in his late 50s. According to legend, reading Hume woke him from his dogmatic slumber. Hume's skeptical arguments about causation and empiricism challenged Kant to respond. In 1781, Kant published Critique of Pure Reason, one of the most challenging and significant works in Western philosophy. Its goal, to answer how knowledge is possible. The Enlightenment debates were polarized. Rationalists, Descartes, Leibniz, thought reason can discover truths about the world a priori. Empiricists, Locke, Hume, argued all knowledge comes from experience, and we can't be sure of anything beyond it. Kant's solution was revolutionary. He said the mind actively shapes experience. We're not passive receivers of data. Our mind has fundamental structures that impose order on the chaotic input of senses. Kant called this his Copernican revolution in philosophy. Just as Copernicus realized we see the heavens moving because of our perspective, Kant realized perhaps objects conform to our way as perceiving, rather than our knowledge conforming completely to objects. In other words, the structure of the world as we experience it, the phenomenal world, partly comes from us. He identified fundamental concepts, categories like causality, unity, plurality, necessity, as built into our faculty of understanding. Likewise, he argued that space and time are not out there, but are forms of human intuition. We perceive everything in space and time because that's the only way our sensibility can present data. The result, we can have certain knowledge, synthetic a priori knowledge, about how objects will appear to us, e.g. mathematics and the basic laws of nature. Because any possible experience must obey those forms we impose, every event must have a cause, etc. However, and this is key, we cannot know things in themselves, noumena, only things as they appear to us, phenomena. So metaphysical speculation about the ultimate nature of reality or God or the soul, which go beyond possible experience, ends up in antinomies, contradictions. For example, Kant shows how pure reason, ungrounded in experience, can argue both that the world must have a beginning in time and that it must be infinite, a sign that reason is overstepping its bounds when it tries to grasp the noumenal realm. In short, Kant carved out a domain for science and knowledge, the empirical, structured by our mind's categories, and a domain where certainty is impossible, the transcendent. This had huge implications. It rescued Newtonian science from Hume's skepticism, but it also limited science's reach. There are things science can't touch, like the existence of God, or the immortality of the soul, or freedom of will as a noumenal capacity. Why does that matter? Enter Kant's moral philosophy. In 1788, he published Critique of Practical Reason, where he argues that while theoretical reason can't know freedom, morality absolutely requires it. We must believe we are free, as moral agents, even if our actions in the phenomenal world are fully determined by natural laws. This is a duality. On one hand, as appearances were determined. On the other, as things in ourselves, we have free will. It's paradoxical, but Kant says it's okay, because the contradiction only arises if we treat human beings as merely phenomena. In the noumenal sense, we can be free, and practical reason, the will guided by moral law, actually gives us a direct insight into our noumenal self. Kant's Ethics, laid out in Groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, 1785, and the Second Critique, centers on the categorical imperative. It's a formulation of the supreme principle of morality. Act only according to that maxim by which you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. Essentially, do only what you would have everyone do in similar circumstances. A test for consistency and universality. Another formulation, treat humanity, in oneself and others, always as an end and never merely as a means. This emphasizes respect for persons as intrinsically valuable, because we're rational, autonomous agents. Kant believed a good will is the only thing good without qualification. Intelligence, courage, wealth, these can be used for ill. But a will that chooses rightly for the sake of duty is unconditionally good. And duty, for Kant, isn't just doing what's right, it's doing it for the right reason, from respect for the moral law, not just inclination or self-interest. He placed moral worth on the motive of duty above consequences or feelings. This strict, deontological, duty-based ethics is both admired and criticized. Admirers say it captures the core of justice and respect. Critics say it's too rigid or doesn't weigh outcomes or emotions enough. The famous example, if a murderer asks you where your friend is, Kant's theory implies you mustn't lie, because if everyone lied, trust would dissolve, so lying fails the universal law test. Many find that counterintuitive. Wouldn't it be better to lie and save a life? Kantians respond by refining the situation or challenging intuitions, but the debate persists. Nonetheless, Kant's idea that people have inherent dignity and that morality is about universalizable principles heavily influenced modern rights-based ethics. Human rights can be traced to Kant's exaltation of each rational being as an end. Kant also wrote on aesthetics, Critique of Judgment, 1790, exploring the nature of beauty and the sublime, bridging the gap between the natural and moral worlds by suggesting our ability to appreciate beauty hints at a harmony between them. He wrote on politics too. In an essay, Perpetual Peace, 1795, Kant proposed a federation of free republican states and hospitality rights, foreshadowing the United Nations and modern liberal internationalism. His ideas on cosmopolitanism and peace through trade and republican government were very forward-thinking. Some call him the father of international law theory or democratic peace theory. To imagine Kant personally, he was, as the anecdote suggests, extraordinarily routine-bound. He never married, was short, about 5 feet, had a quick wit in conversation, but lived a strictly ordered life of teaching, writing, socializing at the same time daily, and taking his constitutional walk. He reportedly never traveled far, not leaving his hometown more than a few times. He was a creature of habit, but his mind ranged across space and time and moral law. He died in 1804, with his famous last words purportedly, "Es ist gut," it is good. On his tomb is inscribed a line from the Critique of Practical Reason. Two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and awe, the starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. This sums up his worldview, a profound reverence for the natural order and the moral order, both of which he saw as pointing towards something higher. Though in line with his critical limits, he argued we can't theoretically know God or immortality, but we have practical reasons to believe in them as postulates for morality's coherence. Legacy, Kant is often deemed the central figure of modern Western philosophy. He synthesized rationalism and empiricism, and his critical method set the stage for 19th century German idealism. Fichte, Schelling, and Schelling. Hegel all started from Kant. Even those who reacted against him, like the existentialists or Nietzsche, were working in a path cleared by him. In analytic philosophy, his logic of concepts influenced the likes of Frege and modern logic indirectly. In continental philosophy, his notions of how we constitute experience influenced phenomenology. Kant's ethical and political philosophy shaped concepts of autonomy and rights. The categorical imperative informs contemporary ethics discussions, like in bioethics. The idea of informed consent and treating patients as ends owes something to Kant. His view of human dignity underpins laws and declarations. the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights echoes Kantian morality in secular form. In metaphysics and epistemology, Kant's idea that we only know appearances, not things in themselves, launched profound questions about realism versus idealism. Are space and time out there or part of our mind's framework? Modern science sometimes parallels this. Some interpreters of quantum physics or relativity note observer involvement resonates with Kant's insight that measurement and observation are not passive. Some criticize Kant for being too rigidly rationalist and duty-focused, neglecting emotion or particularity. Feminist ethicists like Carol Gilligan argue morality is also about care, not just abstract duty. Others critique his noumena-phenomena split as problematic. Why believe in things in themselves if we can say nothing about them? Schopenhauer took Kant and made the thing in itself something we can partially access via will, for instance. And yes, Kant had prejudices of his era. He wrote dismissively of some other races and cultures, reflecting a Eurocentric bias. Those aspects are rightly critiqued today. However, his overall ethical framework has been used to fight racism. The idea that every rational being, regardless of race, must be treated as an end in itself undermines racism if applied consistently, which Kant himself, unfortunately, didn't always do in writing. Nonetheless, learning Kant is often seen as a rite of passage in philosophy, tough but transformative. His clarity of moral vision, act as if your action were to become by your will a universal law of nature, challenges each of us to consider the principles behind our actions, and his humility about the limits of knowledge teaches intellectual modesty that reason must critique itself to avoid illusions. We still live very much in a Kantian intellectual landscape. Whenever we say, well, that's how it appears to us, but who knows reality itself, or when we debate universal moral laws like do not kill, do not lie, or when we talk about innate structures of cognition, as cognitive science does, Kant's spirit is present. The starry heavens still inspire science. The moral law within still inspires moral progress, just as Kant observed with awe more than two centuries ago in Königsberg.